That got my blood going. Watching all you try to clap. And you were helpful. I kind of started getting it after a little while. All right, that is a great, great introduction to our study this morning. Invite you to turn in your scripture to Mark chapter 11. We have Children's Church, I believe, out in the back, and that is available to you. Mark 11, verse 11 through 26. And there's an outline before you. You say, that looks like the outline from last week. Well, we got through half of it last week, which was the plan. And I have changed the title from Turning the Tables to Turning the Tables Again. That took a lot of thinking. But let's dig into it. We're going to hit some of the highlights from last week. This section doesn't, it's a long section, but it doesn't really divide up. If you divide up too much, you are going to lose the thrust of it. So I want to tackle it in this way this morning. So turning the tables again, Mark chapter 11. Verse 11 is where we start off, and we start off last week with this question: are you a religious person? Are you a religious person? And we threw out a couple of caution flags when we think about that question as we interact with it. Religion can be dangerous. And second of all, and we'll come to that in a second, religion can be deceptive. The heart of our worship can be divorced from the one who is to be the heart of all worship. We can be busy, 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 active, and leave out God. And as our text in Colossians said, just leaving him out is the priority of our life. Our worship can be active, it can be busy, but it can leave God out as the top priority. Religion can also be deceptive. And as we talked and discussed earlier, any worship that downplays eternal truth, that fails to build truth upon truth, that does not encompass all the truth of God, degenerates into a man-driven agenda, leaves us with religion only. And a man-centered, self-driven worship agenda never arrives at the blazing glory of God. This text is a worship warning to all people in all generations from the time it is first uttered by the word, by the mouth of Jesus in the temple area, and here in the 21st century in our lives today. Well, the truth we want to build on, and we're building on, that comes out of this passage is that the evidence of true religion is always measured by the fruit it produces. The fruit it produces. We have before us a people who are busy but spiritually barren. Leadership that is busy but spiritually barren. So naturally, we have a nation that is busy but spiritually barren. And we discovered they are cursed by their king. The people in this passage are guilty of leaving the central core of worship. Do we want to leave the central core of worship? The people in this text are guilty of losing the primary meaning of their existence. Do we want to lose the primary meaning of our existence? The people in this text are guilty of leading others away from the true worship of God. And that is why religion is deceptive. Not only can we miss the mark, but we can lead others astray, and others can lead us astray. So we come to the foundational truth of today in this passage. The evidence of true religion is always measured by the fruit it produces. Our target What captures Jesus' attention should capture our attention. Here we have before us four looks that capture Jesus' attention. We looked at two last week. Look number one was the look of observation. In verse 11, Jesus entered Jerusalem. He came into the temple and he looked around at everything. Observation, what catches Jesus' focus, his attention, should capture our focus, our attention, our priority. Jesus looks at everything, and that word there means to scrutinize carefully. He's not there souvenir shopping. He is there assessing spiritual fruit. Fruit of the people, fruit of the religious leaders, fruit of the nation. And this is not the first time he's done this. At the start of his ministry, Jesus comes into the temple, gives it a first review. About 3 years later, it's a second review. It is just as unacceptable. They do not pass inspection. That leads us into verse 12. The look, number two, is the look of inspection. Again, what catches Jesus' attention should capture our attention. On the next day, they left Bethany, returning to Jerusalem in the process. Jesus became hungry, seeing at a distance a fig tree in leaf. He went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. It was not the season for figs. And he cursed the fig tree right there. May nothing ever grow on it again. And as we drop into verse 20, the fig tree has now withered from the roots up the next day. Look number two is the look of inspection. Jesus misses nothing. This is a symbolic act that prophets often did. He is using a literary device familiar with that day. He introduces a subject, then he takes off into another subject. He leaves the tree, goes over to the temple, then he will come back, double back to the tree. All of it is connected. Focusing on the bottom line, this is fruit inspection time for the nation of Israel. And he uses two pictures, the tree and the temple. The tree and the temple. Most of the time last week we looked at the fig tree. And the problem with this particular picture was the false advertising. The fig tree represented the nation of Israel. And as we took a little tour on into treology, biology, or whatever you want to call it, treology, fig trees in that place, in that time, the fruit would come on the leaf, would come on the branch first, and then later the leaf would come on as the fruit continued to mature. What do we see in this picture here? As Jesus goes to the tree, we notice there's leaves on the tree, which would suggest there should be what? Fruit. But there is no fruit, which is the picture of Israel's present spiritual health and condition. Leaves, but no fruit. False advertising. And the religion of Israel, focused on the temple leadership, is a tree without fruit. It is unhealthy. It is bad. It is essentially dead. And the people who are supposed to be pointing the rest of the world to the Messiah are guilty of deceiving the world, sending them down the wrong path. And we come to the point where the tree is going to be removed. It is beyond saving. Now Christ doubles back in his lesson to the temple. Verse 15, they came to Jerusalem and he entered the temple and he began to drive out those who were buying and selling in the temple, overturn the tables of the money changers, the seats of those who were selling doves. He would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. Encourage you to underline that word through. Helps understand a bit of this text. He began to teach in this clearing, temple clearing, highly aggressive, active moment, he is teaching as well. And he began to say to them, "It is it not written?" And he doubles back into the Old Testament. "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations." Underline that phrase, "all the nations." And if you're really into underlining mood, house of prayer for all the nations. But you've turned it into what? A robber's den. That is not a compliment. Let's dig into it. The temple of bad fruit. Remember that evidence of true religion is measured by the fruit it produces. What captures Jesus' attention should capture our attention. His attention is caught by the problem of false advertising, caught by the problem of false activity. The temple. Understand the temple. Understand the stories of the temple, the significance of the temple, temples, plural, and you will understand the Old Testament. Understand the place and the purposes of the temples in Scripture, and you will understand the Newer Testament. You will also understand the complete history of Israel. And you will better understand your place on this planet at this time today. It's all connected. And it's here for our benefit, for our blessing, for our warning, but also to release the unrestrained joy of fellowship with Jesus Christ and fellowship with the body of Christ. Let's get started with this question. Let me give you a quiz. Now, here's your paper. Take your hands and put them out in front of you. Right there. You're going to vote. And you don't have to worry about the guy next to you. You know, no cheating, no looking at anybody else. You're going to use your hands, and I'm going to ask you a question. And it's a number question. And if you think the answer is one, just put up a one. You got it, right? If you think it's nine, put up a one of those, okay? You got it. And this is for you. This isn't to embarrass anybody. This is to kind of get our brain kind of focused around the text and then the application to our life for this week. So here's the question. Remember, you're going to vote now, and I'm going to give about 10 seconds. Don't be bashful. Don't be shy. Don't cheat. Don't sit this one out. How many temples are talked about in the Bible? If you think nine, put up one of those. No looking at your notes. Now, I'm not really looking around, but vote, because I want you to engage your brain here. Now, let me help you fill in some blanks, which is why we're here, to take whatever knowledge we have today, fill in some blanks, move along forward. How many temples are talked about in the Bible? And I'm not talking about pagan temples, but in your notes, you'll see a blank. Let me suggest you write in at least five, because I'm going to talk about five temples. So the answer is at least five. I'll get my blanks out there and help you. Now, the last two, number four and number five, I gave you the answer. The Tribulation Temple, the Millennial Temple. Tribulation Temple, be a focus of Antichrist. Millennial Temple, give you homework, research that on your own. We're not going to talk about those today. But those are two of the five. But we're going to talk about the first three this morning. And to kind of fill in some blanks, And we understand, when we understand better the first three temples, it brings a lot of meaning and clarity to all of the Old Testament, to the life of Christ, to what we read about in the New Testament. The first temple is Solomon's temple. You can write down number one, Solomon's temple. And I'll let you kind of venture out on your own again. Who built Solomon's temple? Anybody want to take a... Who built Solomon's temple? That's like who's buried in Grant's tomb. Who built Solomon's temple? Ah, some of you historians got that. Okay, key figure in the Old Testament, King David. Greatest king Israel had. He wanted to build a temple, and God said, nice idea, you're not the one. You're a man of war, but it was okay for him to collect the stuff, collect the building materials, and his son, the most prosperous king in Israel, at least for a time, takes what his dad collected, builds on his legacy, and builds Solomon's temple. It took about 7 years to build. You read through some of Solomon's life, and you see the off-the-chart opulence, the riches of his kingdom, his palace, his throne, that's transferred into Solomon's temple. It is a magnificent place. And it is destroyed by Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar, that name ring a bell from some of your Sunday school days, and Daniel, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 587 BC. Nation of Israel is carried off into captivity. And to understand the last part of the Old Testament, need to get our brains around the divided kingdom and the captivity. That's Solomon's temple. So the temple has now been destroyed. Israel is off in captivity. And you come to about the last third of the Old Testament, into all the prophets, the major and the minor prophets that we sometimes don't spend a lot of time on. That is when that is what is going on. And the people are able to return from the Babylonian captivity. And a second temple begins. That is the temple of Zerubbabel. You know, I probably should have typed that one in for you. Just put in Z and just take a shot at it. Zerubbabel. This second temple is built after the exile, and it is kind of an on-again, off-project. On-again, off-again project. And what the minor prophets are all about, all those itty-bitty books at the end of the Old Testament, the people get attacked and they quit building the temple. The people get discouraged, they quit building the temple. And some of the ministry of the prophets were, get up, get off the mat, God's not done with you, get back to the first priority in our relationship. And all kinds of great application for us today. At times they needed the correction, and they were corrected, and at times harshly, severely. But we see the grace and mercy of God in the continued existence of Israel and what he's done for them. Well, this second temple is finally finished about 515 B.C. 515 B.C., that's significant because where we're going to land in just a moment. But this second temple was much smaller than Solomon's temple. And again, you see in the minor prophets and the prophets interacting with the people. And when they dedicated Zerubbabel's temple, the people were crying. And some of the tears were tears of sadness, because some of them had seen how the beautiful Solomon's temple. And they knew the second temple didn't measure up in its beauty. That second temple is pretty much intact up until we come into the time of Christ. When we come to the third temple, Herod's temple. Herod, H-E-R-O-D. And perhaps that name starts shooting off, firing off some thoughts in your mind. Let's talk about Herod. Herod is a Roman politician. And part of his selfish political agenda is to kiss babies when it's convenient and murder babies when it's not convenient. Part of his agenda is being nice to the masses when it's convenient for Herod. And for Herod, as he sits in his position, if the area, if the region is calm and sending in their taxes to Rome, then Rome is happy with Herod. If the area, the region is not quiet and calm and peaceful, Herod's going to have to answer to that. And sometimes you keep calm by bribing the people, and sometimes you keep calm by being ruthlessly aggressive and strong. Herod is both of these guys. He's a Roman politician. Part of his selfish political agenda is this temple. Now, you don't have a place for this in your notes, but I want you to write this statement down. Here we go. God uses evil politicians at times as his tools. God uses evil politicians at times as his tools. There has never been a moment, a chapter in history where the God of this Bible has not been on the throne. There will never be a time where he is not sovereignly in control. As the perfect king who dispenses justice and righteousness and also grace and mercy, and we all can be within the splash zone of this almighty, all-wonderful God. This is Herod. This is Herod's temple. About 20 years before Christ is born, Herod begins the building of what we know as Herod's temple today. He somewhat takes apart Zerubbabel's temple, takes it apart, builds on it, expands it as part of his political agenda, criteria that will keep him in power. Begins 20 years before Christ is born. This project takes about 80 years to complete. When Christ is on the scene, it is pretty much done, but it's like our homes. The remodeling project always goes on and on and on and on. In your outline, you see under Herod's temple three bullet points. You might have already filled them in, but I'm going to give you what I would suggest are three bullet points and several more in addition to this. But here are three things to take away from Herod's temple. Number one, this is Jesus' temple, in that when we read that Jesus was in the temple at age 12, this is the temple that Jesus is in, Herod's temple. Herod's temple is the temple where Jesus would have celebrated Passover annually throughout his life. And this is the temple that we now find ourselves in this passage, in this section. Jesus' temple, number one. This temple, number two, is unimagined magnificence. I just write, wow. That would have been a little easier. Jesus' temple and wow. Let me share with you the vote. Okay, you get a vote again. This time you can sit on your hands, just in your mind. What size, how big is the temple area? As you understand it at this very moment, how large would you say the temple area was? Someone came up to you on the street, you're going in to get some groceries, and they say, hey, we want to ask you a question, we're taking a survey. How large do you think the temple is? Just think through it. What would you write on paper right now? Okay, we're going to fill in the blanks a little more, get a little more completion in our incomplete thoughts. It's why we're here today. The area of the temple complex, as I understand it now, equates to about 35 football fields. You know where the football, I was going to ask Bruce the other day, he's like, I started doing the math and like, I'll just go ask the fireman. This is extra credit. You figure it, go figure it out. You know our football field in town? Multiply it by 35. And someone figure out what the dimensions would take it in this community. But the entire temple complex, 35 football fields. Center in the temple is what we often think of, where the sacrifices and altars, the Holy of Holies were located. We understand that the curtain on the Holy of Holies that is torn in two at Christ's crucifixion is probably about 80 feet tall. And around the center area, there are all kinds of columns. Those columns, we have learned, are 15 stories tall. You want to know what 15 stories looks like? I think we've got a picture. I Googled it. Our courthouse, to the very top, they tell me, is 150 feet to the top of our courthouse. Imagine columns that tall. If you're going home today, drive past the courthouse. Imagine it going out some 35 football fields. That gives you an idea of the entire temple complex. Historians that wrote in that era tell us that the outside of the temple building was covered in gold, had a gold roof, and on top of the gold roof there were golden spikes to keep the birds off, because nobody wants the bird doing its business on your gold worship place, right? Imagine a place like that covered in gold. And the historians tell us that during sunrise, the reflection could blind you. And as we've been on the journey with Jesus going up the road, the 3,000 feet from Jericho to Jerusalem, going through the hills and through the valleys, it will get to a point where the pilgrims go over a hill, around a corner, and there they can see the temple out on the horizon. And if you time it just right, it's going to be shining back at you. On a clear day, they would see the temple's brilliance from miles away, which highlights the whole point of this passage. Jesus is evaluating the fruit of temple worship. And we are reminded that worship can be dangerous. It can miss out on truth. And worship can be deceptive. It can peel others off and confuse others. And they miss the truth as well as us. In this moment, as we all stand there looking at the temple with our mouths wide open, appreciating its beauty and its grandeur, we are sobered with this reality as we see in Jesus' actions, the temple is corrupt. And the king has come to pronounce final judgment. And as we look at his next few words, we cannot help but ask, and we should ask, how's our worship? How's our spiritual fruit individually and collectively? Verse 14, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. He's not just talking about a tree. He is talking about the temple. The look of condemnation. What captures Jesus' attention should capture ours, and this is the look of condemnation. Jesus analyzes the total package, and he pronounces doom. Den of thieves. The problem isn't that some things were being bought and exchanged for in the temple area. The key issue is this has become a place of sacrifice shakedown, a place of price gouging. The wolves had descended and they are preying on the prayers. And some of them are not identical ethnicity. The practice has degenerated over time to those coming into Passover. They had to present a lamb or some kind of animal. It had to pass inspection. Well, it has degenerated to the inspectors will essentially disqualify any animal you bring. And then they will sell you their acceptable animal at a huge, huge up price. And you get the sense that, oh, they'll even take your animal that's unacceptable and we'll store it out back. And we get the impression that some of those outback animals would make their way around for someone else. They are shaking down the people. They are fleecing the people. It is unjust. It is prejudicial. It is racist. And it is condemned in the strongest of terms. And the ones doing it, it resembled a farmer's market environment and controlled. It was even called the bazaars of Annas. The family of the high priest. They were controlling it all. And the issue isn't about a fair price. It is unbridled extortion. And often keying in on the Gentiles, who the Jewish people would just refer to as dogs. And this area that the Gentiles were allowed into, that it was to be a place of prayer and spiritual reflection for them, has just degenerated into a casino-type atmosphere. The welcome mat for all the nations has been stolen by leadership greed, all in the name of religion. Religion can be dangerous. Religion can be deceptive. Jesus sets the pace on what is pure, what is true, what is honest and complete worship, and he calls his church to do the same. The fig tree, Israel, withers and dies. The temple, corrupt, condemned, is shut down. Within 40 years, the Roman government will come in and crush the nation. Enter Jerusalem. Remember that magnificent temple? They will level the temple. And for the religious leaders who have their fingerprints all over the crucifixion of Jesus and the cross of Jesus, who about 30, 35 years later find themselves impaled on crosses all across Jerusalem. Rome ran out of wood, ran out of trees for the crosses. And Israel ceased to exist as a nation from 70 AD until just recently in 1948. Three points to write down. Number one, apostate Israel is shut down. But that's not all. God is righteous. God is just. And you mess with God's people even when they deserve. The correction they get brings correction on you. The Roman Empire will not get off the hook. And that second bullet point, evil empires will also be shut down. Let me tackle these next few verses very quickly in just a few moments' time. Verse 20, as they were passing by in the morning, the fig tree was withered up. And verse 22, Jesus answered and said to them, have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it will be granted to him. It will be granted him. Therefore, I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received, and they will be granted to you. Whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you your transgressions. Apostate Israel will be shut down. The evil Roman Empire will be shut down. And often verse 22 and 23 are used to make this statement. If you have enough faith in God, if you have enough faith, God is somehow obligated to move mountains in your life. Mountain of debt, mountain of disease, discouragement, depression. If you have enough faith, God's obligated to respond to that faith. Hang in there for a moment. There's a place for faith. There's a place for prayer. But we need to understand this passage correctly, interpret it correctly, so we can apply it correctly. What is the mountain being referred to here? What would they understand in this moment of time, in this glorious temple? Remember the audience. The key audience is 12 disciples, the first audience. When Jesus spoke of moving by faith this mountain, he was encouraging his disciples to not lose hope, even though they were going to face some tremendous, insurmountable challenges in the days ahead. Challenges from a place called Rome. And the first understanding of this passage and key is to understand, I think, the mountain refers to Rome. These 12 would watch in horror as Rome killed their leader within the week. At least one of these 12, 11 if we take Judas out of the equation, would live to see the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. All of them would be hounded and harassed by the Roman government as they were faithful to their ministry as disciples. As we think of that temple and how it jumped out on the horizon, and as you were there, your focus would be drawn to the temple. The Jewish people would also have their focus drawn one other place. And the people in the temple with those 150-foot columns would see something else. Out over the wall, up the hill, was one other place. Herod's place. Herod's palace. Place where he chose to build for his protection and for his control. Things got out of hand in the temple. He could quickly spot it and send in an army of Roman soldiers to keep the peace, whatever means possible. Herod kind of liked that power. He liked people thinking like that. He liked the idea of people looking up to see him. If you look into history and archaeology, you'll come to a place called the Herodium, a mountain that dominated the skyline of Jerusalem, a mountain that Herod built. In its heyday, it was so extreme, it glistened like a diamond in the desert. Imagine what it would have looked like to see the temple and the Herodium all in one sight. From just a neutral standpoint, it would have been beautiful. You know, this passage talks about faith moving a mountain. Well, slaves can move a mountain. And that's what Herod did. He said, that's where I want my place to be, my fortress, my palace. So he had slaves take dirt from other places and build this huge, huge mountain. This mountain, in verse 23, is going to be cast into the sea. It is a promise. It is a stabilizer for the disciples. God's got this. Evil empires will not last. Evil empires will have their day of reckoning with the King of all kings. The Roman Empire will be shut down. And history gives us that lesson. Herod did have his day of reckoning. The Roman soldiers hightailed it back to Rome eventually and never returned. Apostate religion will be shut down. The evil empire of Rome will be shut down. Fake religion that is man-centered, ego-driven will be shut down. But before we celebrate too far and too loud, we'd better learn the lesson that is here for us. That we need to scrutinize ourselves up close with Jesus. To examine where our worship encounters, our worship day in, day out is dangerous. Not enough priority with Jesus. Where it's deceptive, we've gone off the rails and are leading others astray, or probably more typical, we're not being careful and cautious in who we're listening to and allowing ourselves to be swayed and moved away from the truth of this book, the complete truth of this book. If it can happen to Israel, it can happen to us. If Adam and Eve could crash and burn in a perfect paradise, perfect environment, then I am susceptible to the environment that I find myself involved in. If Peter could be so close, so connected with Jesus, and fall on his face within an evening's time, no place for pride in our life. If Moses could do all the right things and get frustrated with who he's working with and lash out in anger and it be so costly to him, it's a reminder to us. If Aaron and Miriam, who were blessed to be on the inside lane with Moses, could start yearning for more of the inside lane at the expense of Moses and crash and burn, it can happen with us as well. The last look of Jesus is a look of invitation to his disciples, to us as his followers today. We're reminded what captures Jesus' attention should capture our attention. And in this look of invitation, he calls us away from self-worship, being ego-driven. It's all about us, to king worship. In this section, he does talk about prayer. He does talk about faith. He does talk about believing. And as I think about the life of Christ, we notice that displayed in his life, faith, prayer, asking, believing, and forgiving. And that's what he's looking for in all of us. And that's what should be a part of the joy of our worship. What does it mean to have faith in God, which that last section kind of focuses on? Let me just share two things to kind of guide your thinking and actions this week. What does it mean to have faith in God? Number one, my life is a vertical acknowledgement of Jesus as my prophet, priest, and king. Vertical acknowledgement. The one I pray to, the one I sing to, the one I worship, I study, I obey. He's the one that moves mountains. And he is the mountain on which that will always stand and the mountain on which to build our lives and our ministries. My life is that vertical acknowledgement that Jesus is sovereign. He is king. And number two, my vertical life is also horizontally connected in relationships to everyone else on the planet. And all the mess that we see in the world, we see in the mess of the temple. And he calls us all to reflect Christ to be just, to be righteous, to be forgiving, to be merciful, to be grace-driven, to get rid of the injustice and all those things. And it's the church. As a church, we're on the inside lane, in a sense, of reflecting Jesus Christ. May we be faithful to that. As we close this morning, the evidence of true religion is always measured by the fruit it produces. What captures Jesus' attention should capture our attention. And may this be our testimony as we walk out these doors, and even before we walk out these doors, we are coming back to the heart of true worship. It's all about Jesus Christ as our King, as our prophet, as our priest. He is the one that brings the Old Testament and the New Testament together perfectly. He is the one who brings the meaning and purpose to all of our lives. Would you stand with me as we sing this song in commitment, in dedication to the Lord? Lord, help us to have Jesus Christ as the core, central priority of our life. Let's sing together.